Hi, Richard Roxburgh here with another episode of Great Aussie Cons. The Australian past is littered with shady characters who are a touch slippery with the facts. Charming rogues and clever liars. Larrikin lawyer Cleaver Green would have loved them. Very big on imagination, less so on execution. Especially in this ripping yarn, where we take to the sky.
This is a very special flight on its way toward a date with destiny.
And uncover the great Qantas con. Starring one, Mr. Brown. Wednesday, May 26th, 1971. In Qantas' head office in Sydney's CBD, the day started like any other. But around midday, a man calls.
Qantas Airways.
There's a bomb on the Qantas flight. It's just taken off for Hong Kong.
I'm sorry, sir. Could you tell me who's calling?
You just read the notes, and I'll telephone you later. Who are you?
Call me Mr. Brown.
He calls himself Mr. Brown.
I'll tell you a tale, and it won't take me long, about a certain jet plane headed for Hong Kong. Flight 755, bright and shining as the day, a day to be remembered, yes, the 26th of May.
The telephone caller had convinced officials that an altitude bomb had been placed aboard.
A certain Mr. Brown, he was thinking mighty quick.
On that call, Mr. Brown demands $500,000, about $3.8 million in today's money. He says he's put a bomb on a plane, on Qantas Flight 755, a Boeing 707. 133 lives are at risk. And no one's quite sure what to do. Young ABC reporter Alan Hogan is on shift that day.
I was in my late 20s, it was 71. There were only a few newsmen who got a chance to sort of move that quickly to actually cover it while it was happening. And it followed a time when there'd been quite a rise in the number of hijacks of planes.
Unnervingly, many of these overseas hijackings closely resemble a popular American blockbuster, a film that's only just screened in Australia.
There'd been a movie called The Doomsday Flight. The plot of the story was an altimeter-sensitive bomb had been placed on a plane which would explode when the plane descended below a certain level.
Rod Serling's epic story, The Doomsday Flight.
Sit down.
Anybody can fly a plane to New York, but how many crews actually wind up with a bomb?
Rod Serling, the guy who wrote the script for Doomsday Flight, said after the Qantas hoax that he deeply regretted ever writing the film. He said, I didn't know there were so many kooks could come out of the woodwork.
Well, movie buff Peter McCary, a.k.a. Mr. Brown, is one of them. McCary comes to Sydney from England in the late 1960s on a false passport. A small detail he forgets to tell his new backpacker mate, William, who's joined him on a road trip north.
McCary was travelling through Queensland when, with a TV in the back, he watched the Doomsday Flight movie. And the report is that McCary said, that's not a bad way to make some money. William Day, he was regularly writing letters home to his mum. He said he was travelling in Queensland with a Mr. Brown. Day disappeared without trace. That boy was murdered. There's no doubt about that.
On the 26th of May, 1971, months after Mr. Brown and William Day part ways, QF Flight 755 is an hour into its flight from Sydney to Rome via Hong Kong when
Mr. Brown, or McCary as his real name was, made his first phone call to Sydney Airport about midday, maybe somewhere between 11 and 12.
He says to look in locker number 84 at Sydney Airport. The calls are recorded by Qantas. And in the mid-1980s, director Scott Hicks uses transcripts of them in a film he's making about the event. Actor Chris Haywood plays Mr. Brown.
Hello?
Qantas Airways.
Oh, this is Mr. Brown. Can I speak to Captain Ritchie, please?
When the call first came through from Mr. Brown, Captain Ritchie, who was then the general manager of Qantas, was out to lunch. So a guy called Philip Howson, who was the deputy general manager, took the call from Mr. Brown. And then they believed that as the later calls came through from Macari Brown, that Howson should take them in case he thought he was being deceived or something.
Yes, Mr. Brown, well, what can I do for you?
It's all in the letter. I'm going to ring you back at 3 p.m.
What's that? Well, I hope, Mr. Brown, you know, there's nothing going on that would endanger the lives of any of our passengers or the aeroplane.
No, they're all pretty safe right now.
Well, how long for, Mr. Brown?
Pardon?
I say, how long are they safe for?
Shit! Read the letter!
My name is Jim Eames. In 1971, I was press secretary to the Minister for Civil Aviation, Senator Robert Cotton. The moment that situation started to evolve in Qantas in Sydney, Bert Ritchie, the chief executive, or in those days he was the general manager, rung the minister's office.
Bert Ritchie tells Civil Aviation to look for a letter and a replica bomb in a locker at Sydney Airport.
Mr. Brown, he rang them up and said, I put a bomb on the plane, and just in case you think I'm pulling your leg, go to Locker 84 and you'll find the kind of bomb that I put on the plane, which they did.
A certain Mr. Brown, he was thinking mighty quick. He rang Captain Ritchie and said, take it, Captain Cook. There's a shocker in your locker that'll make you mighty crook.
Now, just a recap. Macari, a.k.a. Mr. Brown, has told Qantas that, just like the Hollywood movie, he's put a bomb on board Flight 755 that'll detonate when the plane descends to a certain altitude. So, Qantas decides to put that theory to the test with the replica device found in Locker 84 to see if a bomb really can detect a plane at a certain altitude and then explode. Former ABC reporter Alan Hogan.
Qantas put another plane up, another 707, with the device on board, having taken the connection between the gel ignite and the detonators out, but just to see whether the altimeter device worked, they'd replaced the gel ignite with a light bulb. And when the plane, it went up and then it came down below 6,500 feet or something, the light bulb went off. So they said, oh, this is a device that will actually work. And sure enough, it turned out to be a workable bomb.
Sydney Control to Qantas 755.
Qantas 755, go ahead, Sydney.
We're recalling you to Brisbane to check out a threatening call. And there may be a bomb aboard. Maintain your present altitude. Do not repeat. Do not go below 20,000 feet.
Air traffic control urgently calls the pilot on board Flight 755. By then, it's well on its way to Hong Kong, flying up the Queensland coast. Captain Bill Selwyn takes the call. He's shocked, but experienced in emergency protocol.
We were told that the type of bomb on board was an altitude control bomb, and we did not know what altitude it was set to go off at. We maintained 35,000 feet and diverted towards Brisbane. We were met by an RAAF Phantom jet fighter, which escorted us from Amberley over the Brisbane area.
The Commonwealth Police are on the way.
Now, what's happening with Flight 755 at the moment?
It's still circling over Brisbane.
That's no good. We could be facing a major disaster. Bring it back here and put it on a holding pattern off Botany Bay. We don't want it coming down in people's backyards. And they'd better start searching the cabin.
The Boeing 707 makes a U-turn back to Sydney, and the flight crew gets to work searching for something.
There was a sense of urgency. My mother was thinking there's something more serious than just a fault in the plane, you know.
11-year-old Rita Leonardi's on board Flight 755. It's her first overseas trip to see relatives in Italy.
They were slitting the seats we were sitting on to see if there was anything inside the actual seats. We weren't able to sit back on our seats because of the damage that they made. All the hand luggage was everywhere. The plane looked like it was a wreck. That I'll never forget. It was a very frightening experience.
Did you tell the passengers at any stage that there was a bomb on board?
We told them we were looking for an object, and we searched the aircraft thoroughly, including the passengers' baggage. I didn't mention the word bomb at all.
I certainly remember it as if it was today.
Carmel Guerra is also on the plane with her family, who, like most of the passengers, are first-generation Italian migrants.
They were opening the cabins looking for things, but we weren't sure what it meant. Then they started lifting the carpets, which was, of course, a bit strange. But then when it really hit us was when they moved me from my parents and my cousin Tanina from her parents. That's when we knew. I started crying. My mother was crying, hailing, wondering, you know, why are you taking my daughter away? They grabbed my hand and said in English to my parents, we're taking your daughter somewhere away. And Mum didn't understand. And that's when she got upset and I got upset.
Carmel's cousin, Tonina, is 12. Their parents only speak a bit of English.
Carmel, myself, and Nancy, Carmel's sister, were actually used as interpreters to explain what was going on. It was basically, OK, you're bilingual, you're coming with us. Yeah, my parents were very, very distressed and distraught.
Hours pass. The plane makes it back to Sydney and circles above Botany Bay. Mr. Brown promises to tell Qantas exactly where the bomb is located on the plane, but only once he's got the ransom money. Meanwhile, the public is oblivious to what's happening in the sky above Australia's largest city. Remember, it's 1971. There's no social media, no mobile phones, no rolling news coverage.
There was, fairly early in the piece, a decision that they wanted to keep a lid on it. And it wasn't until, I think, the media got hint of the fact that the Navy was being mobilised to go into Botany Bay. And that was when questions started to be asked.
We interrupt this program to cross live to our reporter at Mascot Airport for a news flash.
The 707 left Sydney with everything indicating just another routine flight to Hong Kong. But the 130 people on board were just settling down when first word of any trouble was heard. There's still a great deal of mystery around the whole incident.
You knew something was wrong when all we saw was water. We were flying around the same area, and it was maintained for what seemed, and it was, hours and hours and hours, and all we could see at the window was water.
It's only a matter of time before a 707 circling above Botany Bay for hours starts raising heads and questions.
The media started to get a hint of what the story was. Then there started to be coverage, at least on radio.
Attention! Attention! This news is happening now!
It seems Qantas has miscalculated public interest, and Mr. Brown, the hoaxer, has miscalculated his numbers.
In Scott Hicks' film, there's that scene where he's on the line with Philip Howson, who was pretending to be Captain Ritchie, and saying...
Let me see now. Look, we're demanding
$50,000. $50,000?
And Howson says, hang on, $50,000? I thought it was $500,000. And Macari Brown says, oh yes.
$500,000.
Sound rather unsure of yourself, Mr. Brown.
I think he was bound to come unstuck because of his clumsiness.
Well, I don't know much about this sort of thing.
Well, how do I know that this is genuine?
Jim Eames was the Minister for Civil Aviation's press secretary.
In those days, we were very proud of our record. You know, civil aviation is not something you toy with. Australians have always been really highly regarded around the world as to how they handle crises in civil aviation.
What does Qantas plan to do?
We're treating this one for real. If we can't find the thing, it's paper chase time.
I'd say it's bloody unlikely there's a bomb on board at all.
They're clever enough to give us a sample bomb that works. They're clever enough to get one on the plane.
All right, if they got one on the plane and it's in a pressurised area, we can find it and disarm it.
I'm not taking any chances, Jeff. Safety's a byword in this organization. We don't trade on it, but everybody knows it.
And if it's a hoax?
And if it isn't?
Macari made 5 phone calls to Qantas House on the afternoon of May the 26th.
Real bomb or not, Macari Brown insists the $500,000 ransom be paid in $20 notes. Meanwhile, Qantas ground staff are searching a Boeing 707 in the hangar for places where a bomb might be hidden on board, and frantically suggesting them to the flight crew in the air above.
How about the main gear inspection window? Have we checked this bulkhead?
Ian, you remember that film I was telling you about?
Oh, Max, we don't have time
again. No. Remember, they found it in the pilot's briefcase.
Right. Bill, have you checked the crew's briefcases?
Yes, Ian. One of us saw the movie too.
The Doomsday Flight, with an exciting cast. Jack Lord. Edmund O'Brien.
Captain Selwyn never used the word bomb. He said, we're looking for a little package. But I guess the passengers, after about a couple of hours of the crew going through all their luggage, all the overhead bins, you'd have to be either very innocent or asleep at the wheel if you didn't think, well, they're looking for something quite serious on this plane.
It's now late afternoon, nearly 7 hours into the flight. Some passengers still think they're on their way to Hong Kong. But the plane's in a holding pattern off Sydney, and fuel's getting low. Macari Brown's waiting for the ransom money to be put in locker 84 at Sydney Airport. But the clumsy hoaxers made another serious miscalculation.
Mr. Brown?
Captain Ritchie?
Yes.
Have you any idea of how much $500,000 is in volume, Mr. Brown?
No idea. It was about 35 house bricks.
Is it honestly?
Yes, it is. Probably went it in the locker.
He makes the demand to have the cash, an enormous amount of cash, which he must have known would be difficult to actually get together in time.
Can you put it in another case?
And then what? Just leave it beside the locker?
No, look, it's going to be picked up from, in Sydney itself. Whereabouts in Sydney?
And then he says, oh, just deliver it to me. I'm going to turn up in a canary yellow combi van outside the front door of Qantas House.
Brown instructs the general manager of Qantas, Bert Ritchie, to take the ransom money outside Qantas House, alone. Then, on his signal, past the suitcases stuffed with $25,000 $20 bills, through the front window of the yellow combi.
When Bert Ritchie came down in the lift to deliver the money, the plan was to have some police who were already with Qantas in that building come with him. But Bert took the fast lift down, which didn't stop at any stations, and they finished up coming down 5 or 6 floors in the stopping lift. They basically got the wrong lift.
Which stopped at every floor on the way down.
Bert Ritchie sees the van, but the cops are nowhere in sight. They're still stuck in the all-stops lift.
And by the time they got there, Mr. Brown and the yellow combi had completely disappeared.
The hoaxer, Mr. Brown, collected the $500,000 from the general manager of Qantas, Captain Ritchie.
Door closed, off went the van with the $500,000.
And it wasn't till 6 o'clock that Macari rang them and said, oh, by the way, there's no bomb on the plane. It can land quite safely. And so, yes, there are accounts that Selwyn said there were about 6 minutes of gas left in the plane when he touched down at Mascot.
The plane didn't actually land. The plane just literally dropped.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the captain. I'm pleased to be able to tell you that our technical difficulty has been resolved.
And they didn't say we're landing back in Sydney. They didn't tell us anything until we landed in Sydney and told us where we were.
And it's down. It looks like a safe landing.
I recall my mother nearly kissing the floor when we arrived.
that's over.
The passengers are finally allowed off the plane and immediately put in a queue for the next flight to Rome. No trauma counselling in 1970s Australia.
Yes, and some of the passengers wanted to not continue and wanted to go back to Melbourne. And that was not an option. It was, no, we're going. Everyone back on a plane and off we go.
There was no conversation, recognition.
There was no explanation given to us, neither at Sydney, neither when we arrived at Rome.
You know, that a lot of that would have occurred because we were a bunch of Italians going back to Italy who were probably grateful to be alive, in fact.
All hijinks aside, it was hugely distressing for passengers on board Flight 755. Tonina Guerra has never been able to fly again.
The only bomb was the original one found in a locker at the airport.
Over the next few days, the media's drip-fed the story. The abandoned yellow van is found, but not the money or the hoaxer. Qantas is tight-lipped. It's been duped. And the culprit, Mr. Brown, and his mate Raymond Poynting, yes, turns out he had a sidekick, have got away.
We did it, Ray.
We'll never get away with it.
We have got away with it.
Now all we've got to do is lie low until things cool off. I want to go back up north.
You better keep the lid on your spending.
Dolores looking over every single place in town. So far they found the car, but not a certain Mr. Brown.
The task of finding the so-called Mr. Brown, of finding the person or persons responsible for the bomb ransom, has been given top priority by the whole of the New South Wales Police Force.
That the man was also wearing dark-rimmed spectacles.
Police have built up an identikit picture of the man who collected the money. One picture shows him with a beard, another picture shows the man clean-shaven.
They put out a $50,000 award for information leading to the arrest.
In 1971, 50 grand is a huge amount of money. TV journos jump on every lead.
What I actually did was a story about how hard it was going to be for Mr. Brown to get rid of $500,000 in cash in $20 notes.
Including a young Alan Hogan.
Seems Mr. Brown has got big problems. He can't take his money to a bank, he can't take it out of the country. As if that wasn't enough, he's got police in six states hunting for him.
The police received something like 14,500 calls.
I think Macari made the fatal error when he got the money to sort of go on a spending spree.
But it wasn't till Raymond Poynting arrived at a servo in a series of incredibly expensive cars.
Looks like Macari's sidekick couldn't help himself. He's a regular customer who usually drives a bomb. So service station staff alert the cops.
One of our customers has turned up with two brand new cars in the last couple of weeks.
She became very suspicious, and so she rang the police and said,
first was an E-type Jag, now it's a Chevy Camaro.
He's only a barman. I can't work out where he's getting all this dough from. And so at least to the credit of the police, they followed it up.
Bright yellow, yeah. Now, about this reward.
It was Macari they picked up first in the flash car, and they started to look at both of them and say, what's happening here?
The cops bring Macari in for questioning, but his story starts to seriously unravel when his accomplice is picked up.
What's your full name?
Raymond James Poynting. They arrested him and he just spilled the beans straight away. I done it, and I did it with Peter King. Raymond Poynting never knew Macari's real name. Poynting arrives at the police station and Macari's already under arrest and says,
Is this the man you know as Peter King? Yeah, it is. I put it to you that you are, in fact, Peter Pasquale Macari, wanted in England on various charges.
Macari?
I'm Peter Macari, and I'm Mr. Brown.
Both men are sent straight to the clink. And with almost all the ransom money still missing, they don't stand a snowflake's chance of bail. And they keep their mouths shut. A few months later, they face court.
The defendants, Poynting, curly blonde hair, wearing a white polo neck sweater and dark trousers. Macari, small, dark, sharp-featured, and not once did anyone mention the name Mr. Brown.
Macari is sentenced to 15 years.
It was a hoax. But in fact, if you tried to say, well, you actually threatened people's lives, he didn't. He demanded money with menaces, and that's what he went to jail for.
But where's the money? I mean, a loose 500 grand doesn't just go missing. Well, 6 months after the hoax, an anonymous tipster tells cops that some of the ransom money's been stashed in a bricked-up chimney in Annandale. They find more buried under a house in Balmain. But half the money is still out there, somewhere.
Where that missing 280,000 went is a very good question. There's some speculation that he might have put it in a waterproof safe and dumped it off Bondi Beach, but, you know.
But before you go deep diving at Bondi, there's also a speculation the money may have helped make Macari's stay in prison just a little more comfortable. And his release a little earlier, perhaps. Because in 1980, completely out of the blue, after serving only 9 of his 15 years sentence, Macari is set free.
And I wonder why he got off with 9. I looked at that very closely and I can't see any reason why he would not have served out his full sentence. And I can't find any reason why he might have been given early parole.
And that's where our trail seems to stop. After his release, Peter Macari is flown straight back to his native country, England. On what? Well, a Qantas jet, of course. There he opens a fish and chip shop and goes quiet. Until 5 years later, while making his film about Mr. Brown's heist, director Scott Hicks gets a phone call out of the blue from Peter Macari. Reverse charges, of course. Macari's heard about the film on the grapevine and wants to know what's in it for him. Some people just don't know when to down tools. You've been listening to The Qantas Con in our series about great Aussie cons of the past. The producer was Ros Bluett and the sound engineer Russell Stapleton. I'm Richard Roxburgh. Looking forward to your company for our next con job about a young woman of very little means, but a very big imagination. See you then.